Like all the greatest bel canto masterpieces, Gaetano Donizetti's Anna Bolena was written to glorify the voice above all. But this opera also brings two hugely important historical personalities to life, England's King Henry VIII and his second wife, Anne Boleyn. Anne is, in fact, one of the most formidable prima donna roles in all of bel canto. The powerfully dramatic scenes for her and the principal characters surrounding her give ample opportunity for acting and music making that abound in both elegance and passion. Hello, I'm Roger Pines, dramaturg of Lyric Opera of Chicago, and it's my pleasure to speak to you about Anna Bolena. This was actually one of several Donizetti operas that brought the Tudor era of English history to the stage, although, of course, it was history considerably adapted and embellished for theatrical purposes. While Anna Bolena brings us Henry and Anne, three Donizetti operas presented their daughter, Queen Elizabeth II, Elisabetta al Castello di Kenilworth, Maria Stuarda, and Roberto Devereux. Anna Bolena dates from 1830, when Donizetti was in his early 30s. At that point, he'd produced 28 operas, and there would be at least 30 more during the 15 remaining years of his career. This opera brought him greater attention and success than any previous work. It premiered in Milan, but not at La Scala, instead at its competition, the Teatro Carcano. Donizetti chose a celebrated librettist, Felice Romani, who'd already collaborated with Rossini, Bellini, and Donizetti himself. The title role was written for one of the greats of the bel canto era, a true singing actress, Giuditta Pasta. The following year, she created two very different but equally iconic roles, the heroines of Bellini's La Sonnambula and Norma. Donizetti was unhappy with the world premiere of Anna Bolena. He said in a letter that it couldn't have been given a worse performance. But the public responded differently. The piece took Donizetti's name across Italy and the continent, from England and France to Russia, and 8 years after the premiere, to America. By the late 19th century, though, it had faded from sight, as Verdi and then Verismo began to dominate Italian repertoire. In 1957 at La Scala, director Luchino Visconti and conductor Gianandrea Gavazzeni brought the piece back as a vehicle for Maria Callas. Together, they awakened a generation of opera-goers to the riches of this work. I'll be illustrating my comments with a live recording of that extraordinary production. With Callas' Anne, joined by mezzo-soprano Giulietta Simeonato as Jane Seymour, bass Nicola Rossi-Lemeni as Henry VIII, tenor Gianni Raimondi as Sir Richard Percy, and mezzo-soprano Gabriella Carturan as Smeaton. Anna Bolena finds Donizetti de-emphasizing the incredible vocal pyrotechnics required in the Rossini repertoire. Yes, there are fireworks in Anna Bolena, but they're more infrequent. The music is built on a larger scale. The priorities are legato melodies, thrustingly dramatic cabalettas, sweeping ensembles, and dialogues between the principals that generate a crackling theatrical excitement. It's 1536, an evening in Windsor Castle, and we're in the Queen's apartments. The courtiers comment to each other. They know Anne's great days as Queen are long gone. Henry's already interested in someone else. Among the ladies present is Anne's friend Jane Seymour, and she's desperately apprehensive. Anne doesn't know that Jane is her rival for Henry. When Anne appears, she's in a melancholy mood and calls on Smeaton, the young court musician, to sing to her. He's in the middle of his song when she cuts him off abruptly. She's upset, and she gives us her first outpouring of emotion. Anne feels shaken by memories of her first love, and she isn't singing about Henry. This is a classic Donizetti aria. The line has to be handled with maximum delicacy and a searching, inward-looking quality of expression.
Thank you.
warns Jane, "If the splendor of a royal throne should ever seduce you, just remember my misery and don't let yourself be deceived." Anne's been waiting all evening for Henry to appear, and when he doesn't, she finally leaves. Jane wonders if she somehow betrayed herself to Anne. We now meet Henry VIII himself, a role meant for a grand-voiced basso cantante. The role was written for Filippo Galli. Considering what an important star he was, it's surprising that Donizetti didn't actually give him a real aria in this opera. But Henry is a hugely imposing role nonetheless. He's entered through a secret door, and when Jane sees him, she begs him to let this be their last conversation. She won't be the other woman in his marriage. She wants his love, but she also wants to keep her good name. He wonders if she feels the same ambition to be queen that Anne felt back when she longed for the crown held by Henry's first wife, Catherine of Aragon. He reveals that he despises Anne. He's planning to dissolve their marriage vows. Jane hopes this won't be accomplished through cruelty. All of this emerges in the first of the opera's extended duets, in which Donizetti wonderfully contrasts Henry's machismo with Jane's gentleness. Surrounding the castle, Anne's brother, Lord Rochford, our supporting bass baritone, encounters Sir Richard Percy, our leading tenor. After Percy's long exile, the king has ordered him to return. Percy has heard that Anne is unhappy. Of course, his love for her is hopeless. His aria reveals that he's been miserable since the day she was lost to him. This legato melody would have been decorated with a good deal of filigree had it been written by Rossini, but Donizetti has a quieter, manlier style for his tenor arias. The first Percy was Giovanni Battista Rubini, who was famous for his ease in the extreme upper register. But surprisingly, Percy's first aria makes no major excursions high above the staff. Da quel dì che lei perduta, disperato, d'invando andai, da quel dì che il mar passai, la mia morte cominciò. Ogni luce a me muta, dai viventi a me divisi, ogni terra com'io m'assisi, la mia tomba mi sembra. There's to be a hunt. The king appears with a royal official, Lord Harvey, our supporting tenor. Also on hand are the ladies-in-waiting, the king's guards, and Anne, who's startled to see Percy. He's respectful before the king, who restored him to England and to his ancestral home. Henry assures him that it was Anne who proclaimed Percy's innocence, leading to his return. But we also learn that Harvey, on the king's orders, is planning to have Anne and Percy spied upon. Henry makes a big show of officially pardoning Percy for any crime, and he hopes that Percy will remain at court. Everyone goes off to the hunt. We move to a small room near Anne's apartments. Smeaton, who's infatuated with Anne, had stolen a locket containing her portrait. He now wants to return it. He's about to do so when he hears people approaching, so he hides behind a screen. It's Rochford and Anne. She agrees to his plea that she see Percy. When he appears, she confesses that her ambition for the crown led her to betray their love by marrying Henry. Percy's ready to forget the anger he felt. She's worried for him and begs him to leave her. You hear the deep vein of sadness that's central to much of Donizetti's music for Anne. In previous bel canto operas, this duet would probably have come to a big, grand, flamboyant conclusion, but Donizetti ends it comparatively abruptly, because he clearly doesn't want to hold up the proceedings for applause. The drama needs to continue uninterrupted. Percy's about to stab himself when Smeaton bursts out of hiding, assuming that Percy's intending to strike Anne. The two men are about to duel over her when the king appears. He takes one look, and he assumes that Anne and the men are all guilty. Smeaton now makes a disastrous mistake. He kneels before the king, proclaiming Anne's innocence. "Kill me, naked and unarmed, if I'm lying." And as he tears open his tunic, Anne's portrait falls out. Henry is livid. Along with the courtiers, ladies, and soldiers, Jane has appeared with Henry, and this whole situation horrifies her. Anne begs for a word from her husband, but he answers, "Not from me. The judges will hear you defend yourself." That word stings Anne. "Giudici, Adonna," she repeats, "judges for Anne." And she launches into the finale of Act One with the words, "Ah, my fate is sealed. If my accuser is the man who condemns me." It's one of the great test places for any soprano singing Anne. How much outrage can she bring to the utterance of those three words, "Giudici ad Anna"? She then has to continue with that level of emotion in punching out very aggressive lines in the lower middle register. Everyone else adds their opinion of the situation, but it's Anne who's at the center of everything at this moment. "Giudici ad Anna! Effect under house arrest. In the rooms where she's being held, her ladies wonder where all the crowds are who used to acclaim her. Even Jane Seymour has kept her distance, but Jane now unexpectedly appears. Anne sees that she's pale and trembling. Jane reveals first that Henry is planning to break the bonds that tie him to Anne, but she adds that Anne, by admitting her own guilt, can save her life. Jane reveals, too, that it's not only the king who's advising her to do this. She's being begged to do it by someone Jane describes as the wretched woman whom Henry's love has destined for the throne. "And who's the woman who would dare such a thing?" snaps Anne, and she curses that woman. Jane now finally confesses that it's Jane herself. At first, Anne is appalled, but Jane admits that her error came from an inexperienced heart. Anne finally declares that it's Henry who's guilty. She says to Jane, "Go now and with you take Anne Boleyn's pardon. The legato of Anne's lines at the start of this passage is written to present her calm, her acceptance, and her sheer nobility at this heartfelt moment. Jane responds that this forgiveness is even worse than the scorn she was afraid she'd feel from Anne. Now the throne will be Jane's punishment. Her lines are more vaulting, more sweeping than Anne's, emphasizing the outpouring of relief that the queen hasn't rejected her. The confrontation between Anne and Jane ends with their voices finally uniting, singing in thirds, a mode of vocal writing that the bel canto composers almost invariably used in duets for two women. In the final pages, Jane is given the top line, as if to anticipate that she will indeed soon be queen. In the antechamber outside the room where the king's council is in session, one group of courtiers tells the other that Smeaton is at this moment being questioned. Harvey emerges from the council chamber, asking that Anne and Percy be summoned. He reveals that Smeaton has admitted to a relationship with Anne, assuming this was the only way to save her. Henry appears, so does Anne. She asks to be spared the upcoming trial. He's declaring to her, "You're the wife of Henry, yet you lowered yourself to a Percy." But Percy himself now appears and hears that insult. He's enraged. He proclaims before the king that Anne is innocent. Henry reveals that Smeaton confessed and named 100 witnesses. Anne is now beside herself. She calls this accusation evil and insists that Smeaton was sucked into the confession by Henry himself. Percy proclaims that he and Anne are, in fact, married. "From your earliest years," he insists, "you've been mine, and you know it. You left me, but I loved you even when you were unfaithful." Henry orders his guards to take Percy and Anne before the council, adding that another woman will soon take Anne's place on the throne. Singing with total conviction and unity, Percy and Anne express their hope that Henry's subjects will never know how cruelly he's treated their queen. Even in three-quarter time, Donizetti is able to give this music a fantastically aggressive, driving style, highlighted by the thrilling climactic ascent of Henry's solo line as he proclaims that Anne's name and blood will be forever hated, disgraced, and rejected.
Quanto, 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 qu
After Anne is led away, Henry is confronted by Jane, who continues to be torn apart with guilt. Henry proclaims that the two of them will soon be married. Jane loves him, but she can't bear to be the cause of Anne's undoing. As with many other scenes in Anna Bolena, Jane's biggest moment takes the conventional cavatina cabaletta form, a stately, ultra-expressive aria followed by a more vigorous, showier aria with connecting recitatives in between. At the time of this opera, the mezzo-soprano as a vocal category was still in a state of transition. You can hear in Jane's cavatina that this is an important bridge role between what Rossini gave the mezzos in his more dramatic works and the powerhouse mezzos in the Verdi operas that came a quarter century after Anna Bolena. Now Harvey emerges from the trial with important news. Anne's marriage has been annulled. Not only that, she's been condemned to death, as have the men who are viewed as her accomplices. He doesn't give the names, but we can assume he means Percy, Rochford, and Smeaton. The courtiers are there, begging Henry to spare Anne, and Jane adds her voice. Heaven, she says, views mercy as Henry's duty, but she gets no response from him. Jane's cabaletta showcases the singer's power, range, and rhythmic drive. And here's one moment where Donizetti chooses to give the mezzo an enormous challenge in terms of sheer vocal display. Of the Callas Visconti Gavazzeni production, few tenors could manage the demands of the first portion of the final scene, so it was cut in performance. What happens there is that Rochford and Percy meet in the Tower of London. They learn that they've been pardoned by the king, but when Harvey tells them Anne is to die, they resolve to die as well. They return to their separate cells, and now Anne's ladies-in-waiting appear, expressing their concern for her. Anne is not herself. Her mind is wandering back to the day she married Henry. She's worried about Percy reproaching her, but in her mind she sees him smiling at her. Now she thinks of her happy youth and of the day she fell in love with Percy. This type of elegiac, nostalgic aria is really the epitome of bel canto. The singer has to pay careful attention to the ebb and flow of the line. It needs incredible grace and shading. Oh. When Smeaton appears with Percy and Rochford, he kneels before Anne and laments that he betrayed her. She prays that her suffering may end, doing so in a beautiful quartet in which the men ask heaven to give her relief. The melody sung by Anne here is Donizetti's homage to a hugely well-known song by Sir Henry Bishop. He'd composed it for his opera of 1823, Clary, and it subsequently became one of the most beloved songs ever written in any language, Home, Sweet Home. From offstage, we hear cannon sounds and bells. They're part of the king's wedding procession. Anne knows that the only thing needed to complete the crime of this marriage is the shedding of her blood. In going to her execution, she nobly declares that she isn't crying out to have vengeance on Henry and Jane. She will ask that they be pardoned by heaven. Here, at its most powerfully and incisively dramatic, is the glory of the human voice. Original sound recordings of musical excerpts used by permission of Warner Classics.